and welcome to LedgerCast. My name is Brian Krogsgaard. I am here today with a special guest. We got Diana Biggs, a crypto OG, but also part of the institutional world, the CEO of Valour Global. Hey, Diana, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing well. I didn't know that you were like so official and like had these big jobs between HSBC before and you're teaching at Oxford. I just knew you because we're in some like degenerate crypto chats together. And then I found out you were all serious and official. So I'm happy to have you on.
Well, you know, I straddle between both worlds, probably don't fit into either, but that's what allows me to serve as an ambassador of sorts between them both.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's my pleasure to have you on because I want to learn your story in crypto, and then we'll dig a little bit into the institutional side of Bitcoin and crypto as well. Before we do get started, this episode is brought to you by Set Protocol. Go to ledgersize.com/sets and check it out today. They make automated investing easy, where you can follow strategies or tag along with someone else and the trades that they make. And you can go to ledgersize.com/tulip and check out one that I made. So yeah, thanks to Set Protocol for being a partner on the show, and check out ledgersize.com/sets. So Diana, let's start with what year were, like, when you say OG, people sometimes say that I'm an OG now, which makes me very uncomfortable because it's like I didn't buy my first Bitcoin until early 2017. So it's not, I don't feel like that's OG any, even if people entering 2019, 2020, 2021 do. But you've been in for a long time. So when did you first get into crypto?
So when I first got really interested and started to watch it, Bitcoin and take it seriously was 2013. I had actually heard about it earlier on, but through a friend who works in corporate intelligence, and she does a lot around investigating money flows and had been looking at it for that reason. And I think because I had a background in technology and finance, had asked me about that. But at the time, it I don't think I'd really grasp the importance of it, especially listening to it in that particular context. It didn't quite resonate. But in 2013, I had just moved to New York City after living and working across sub-Saharan Africa for a number of years. And I was actually with my younger brother, who is a computer programmer in New York City, and he started showing me Bitcoin. And I think that's when it really resonated as a potential new form of money, because of the issues that I had had with money living in a country where financial services were a bit trickier. And then after that, in New York, I was actually a co-founder of an e-commerce platform that was running between Nairobi, Kenya, and the United States, and we were having quite a few issues with money transfer as well.
So,
and it just seemed like this could be a possible solution in some way, at least, to digitize money, essentially.
Yeah. So you really got in it from a fundamental perspective first, not like thinking about price appreciation and all that.
Yeah, no, definitely the more sort of investment side, or looking at it as something to trade in terms of the value of something and what money you can make off of it, isn't the angle that really resonated with me.
Yeah. At what point did that shift where you were like, oh, wow, you know, I bought a Bitcoin and it was $200 and then now it's $1,000 or something like that. And, you know, you started to realize this was not only interesting from a money perspective that you can, you know, move around easily, but also an investment perspective.
You know, I don't think that's what was really what it was about for me, to be honest.
But it didn't. I mean, it just never, like, did that eventually click where you were like, oh, you know, the Bitcoin that I bought at some, you know, point in the past is now worth so much more than it initially was? Or was it just something that you tried not to think about?
I think for me, that appreciation and value was more symbolic of the potential growth and power that the network would have, as opposed to me thinking this is something that I need to store in order to create wealth. But I think that's really just because, and that maybe that's my own naivety, creation of wealth wasn't a focus.
Yeah.
Or wasn't what I found really fundamentally interesting about Bitcoin or about the entire space.
So what did resonate with you beyond, you know, saying, oh, well, this is something that makes sense to me based on the travels that I had? Like, what clicked for you to stick with it?
Well, I think what really resonated to me with me was that it reminded me of the early 90s. In the early 90s, I started using the internet, really even before there was a web, and in a lot of text-based chat rooms and kind of part of an early community, also with 2600, which is the Hacker Quarterly, and there were meetups that we would go to every month, which are sort of the first type of meetups that I was ever aware of before there was any websites, let alone one for meetups.com. And we would just sort of tinker with new technologies and think about a future that actually, then there was the launch of Wired magazine as well, and a lot of thinking and ideals about, I guess, like a cyberpunk vision, which is really around information wanting to be free and how it could connect the world. And for me, that was really what was fundamentally interesting, was about how do we get access to information. And the fact, I suppose, as a young teenager, that I was part of an internet world at the time was very much a text-based one, but about people who were really curious about technology, the power of it, and connecting about ideas and sort of a vision of, well, a new world. We actually even sort of lived inside these, this is really nerdy, but online worlds. There was MUDs and MUCs, and you would connect with people and meet them there. And then I would go to my middle school and then my high school and tell people about this internet and my friends who lived around the world and the people that I would connect with, and things like the Hope Hackers on Planet Earth convention in New York City, and these ideas and the potential of using like telephone lines for connecting and sharing information and spreading information, and just had people look at you completely blank.
And like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, and just like, I don't know what kind of bizarre world you're speaking about, but that will never happen. And that's just not how things are. And then, you know, you fast forward 15 years and it's just absolutely how all of us live our lives. And it's the complete norm. But really, for a good number of years there, 5 to 10 years, it was still very much something that was niche. And that was for like a certain type of, say, nerdy person or people who were interested in from an entrepreneurial perspective, or what kind of money they could make out of it or whatnot.
Yeah.
So I think, and at the time, I didn't pursue computer science. I just went a different route. I was studying biochemistry and architecture, and technology was always part of what I worked in. But it wasn't my main focus for my career. I guess it didn't seem like even a possibility at that time necessarily.
Yeah.
And so I think when I started going to meetups and meeting other people in 2013 that were interested in this technology, and that's just the kind of atmosphere that was in some of those early meetups, it really reminded me of those 2600 meetings in the 1990s. And just from having had that experience where this internet that we were all sort of playing around with or experimenting with actually became like the core basis of our world and our way of interacting and our economy, it made it seem less crazy that this might then be the continuation of that and be the foundation for integrating financial services and new ways of building economies into the digital realm.
Yeah, especially with how open the web was too, because I came from the web and I was working full time in web stuff by 2011. And, you know, most of the monetary transactions were super company to company, you know, like you had to be using PayPal or whatever. And having the idea of more of an open protocol that's a native digital money makes a ton of sense. It just took a while for it to click with me, but it's pretty cool how you were able to translate that from, I think of like IRC, like I don't know mm-hmm. the names of the specific chat rooms that you were talking about, but you know, I remember IRC and
popular,
yeah. Some of the different things, the like chat stuff that was built off that in the '90s and
yeah.
Talking
in 1994, I was building internet sites for one of the world's biggest telecommunication companies.
Oh, wow. Oh man, and I can't remember.
That was another parallel.
What was that intranet that was so popular? So difficult, but
yeah, at the time the large companies they were saying like, no, it'll be intranets, and it's sort of similar to how they all wanted their private blockchains.
Yeah, it's like only for us and like closed in within our organization. So when did that translate to saying, okay, well, I'm an early adopter of Bitcoin to this is more than just a thing that's a hobby, or like I see real potential? Cause when did you make a shift? You said you studied biochemistry and stuff, but you got into finance at some point along the road. So when did you make the shift into doing this kind of stuff more full time?
Right. So after my undergraduate degree, I actually worked for a sustainable development think tank in London, helping them to integrate technology into their work. And after that, I did an MBA, from which I went into management consulting, but in financial services.
Okay.
So I was advising a lot of the world's largest financial institutions for about 5 years. And I think because I'd previously worked in sustainable development and also had worked in technology and was quite interested in entrepreneurship, I was working mainly in markets on projects that were more entrepreneurial, about building out financial systems or building new projects or new companies, and started doing quite a bit of work in sub-Saharan Africa, predominantly South Africa and Nigeria. And I think it was working in some of those countries where I became quite interested in access to financial services and financial inclusion and how technology might play a role in that.
And both countries were like super rapidly developing at the time, right?
Yeah, those were the two largest. I mean, one project that I did for a South African bank was actually to analyze the financial services markets and the potential for them to grow across every country in sub-Saharan Africa. And there you're looking at things like, what is the political atmosphere? What is the ease of doing business? What is the banking sector built on? What's the monetary policy? And there's so many factors to consider when looking at that. Nigeria and South Africa are obviously the largest. And I think there it's really interesting also to think about what are all the considerations that come into play when you're looking at different financial systems and why they do or don't work, or what those issues might be, which also brings other parallels or other considerations in mind when we're looking at actually creating an entirely new system from scratch, or creating a global system that is independent of any government, which was another aspect that was really interesting here.
So were you interested in other cryptocurrencies at the time? Because maybe start here. For a long time, people were like, oh, well, this is just 1.0. There'll be some other thing that comes up, or like, we're going to make Bitcoin but better and call it something else. Like, all the altcoin landscape, it was different then than it is today. Whereas today, not as many people are trying to replace Bitcoin. They're trying to say like, okay, well, here's a thing that we do that's also like on the blockchain or in crypto. Whereas then it was like, here's Bitcoin, but better. And it's called Decred, or, you know, like whatever else, you know, people may come up with tons of coins back in like 2014 and stuff. Were you pretty convinced of Bitcoin's staying power itself, and how severe was that kind of fight around like what cryptocurrency would win?
Yeah. So in 2013, as I mentioned, when I moved to New York City, I was co-founder of an e-commerce platform. Our goods were being made and our main headquarters was in Kenya, but we were operating in San Francisco and New York. And there were some issues with moving money there. And then around the same time, I started watching Bitcoin more closely. And actually, by the end of 2013, I was approached by an investor who I knew through contacts in New York, who said that he wanted to start an exchange, a crypto exchange in London. And I was one of the few people who had experience in financial services and in London. I had been based in London for many years and an interest in Bitcoin. And so actually I left,
brings a little flair to the stream.
I actually left my startup in early 2014 to come over to London to focus on crypto full time. So it was really less than a year of paying attention to the Bitcoin space that I took the decision
I gotta get deeper in this.
Yeah, exactly. And I came over to London, which had a really fantastic scene at the time of people who were exploring this in different capacities. I remember there were some individuals working at Barclays Bank. None of them, they're no longer there, but they were all very sort of supportive of startups who were exploring the space and willing to have that conversation. Going to some of the early crypto conventions in San Francisco in early 2014. And that's actually where I met some of the Ethereum founders. And that was a project that really sparked interest because of looking at the possibilities where you can sort of go beyond
just the narrow scope of money, right? Like the transfer back and forth. Were they talking about Ethereum in terms of smart contracts and like trying to imagine all the possibilities? Was that all day one stuff in terms of how they talked about it, or how did that evolve?
Yeah, I would say that it was. I remember, there was a lot of talk about, there was some projects like colored coins, but I think fundamentally the thinking was about looking at smart contracts, how to go beyond, how to make programmable money. That was really the focus of what more you could do there. It took a while for it to actually get launched because it obviously took a lot of work and there was a lot of different people working on it in different places, but got quite involved in exploring what that could look like and what it could be. And very much the central focus there was decentralization and how to take that even further.
Were people talking about Ethereum? Because this people talking about the idea of Ethereum, and then the ICO was public, right? So
it was about a year later. Yeah.
Yeah. So the idea of Ethereum was out for quite a while before the actual sale.
Yeah, a couple of years.
Was the narrative about it becoming a replacement for Bitcoin, or was it always designed to be complementary?
I think that it was complementary, but certainly you had factions of individuals who were sort of staunchly behind one or the other.
Some things never change.
And I guess it got quite heated at times, but I think a lot of people, especially, I mean, it sort of depends on what community. You know, there's a number of different communities within a community. At the conferences, there was a lot of the early entrepreneurs in the space, so some that are no longer in the space and some that are still around. Definitely the early companies were like BitGo, Coinbase, some of the early investors. I remember Chamath speaking in 2014 and at the conference in San Francisco and telling everyone to put at least 1% of their net worth into Bitcoin.
Wow, he's pretty early to that.
Yeah, so it's definitely like Bill from Abra, the guys from Steve Waterhouse, who's at Pantera Capital. There was Brock and Roger Ver and sort of those early sort of evangelical type individuals promoting the space, but it was still a relatively small community at the time. And then I think in different forums, for example, I think it was late 2014 or early 2015 when I met Crypto Cobain and then AABTC that I know someone had asked about earlier, and they were definitely looking at things from the trading perspective. And so then that was sort of a community that was just looking at it from from that angle more so, but then obviously also understanding different aspects of it as well.
Yeah, and it seems like those really flipped a lot, where the people looking at crypto from an investment perspective or from a trading perspective, that side of things got a lot bigger. And the people that were especially early adopters were much more purist in one way or another, or like it was maybe even more political in a way, based on they got, you know, because they got into it because of things they believed, not because of the number moving all over the place, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, so then that was almost a different category of people who were very, it was very much about sort of a fundamental political belief. And I think certainly some of the Bitcoin Core developers or people like Drac and Peter Todd, and I think at the time also 2014, through them, I also met Amir Taki. And it was really about, it was really about the movement and the meaning of it and sort of going against being a decentralized system, being a system of money outside of government. They didn't feel like that the government should have that control, and why not just create a system that's completely outside of that? And I think that was important to a lot of people. And then others needed to find a way to reconcile those ideals and those ideas, which still exist, are an important part of the system, with just the reality of the world that we live in today, and where do you find that common ground? And it's important, of course, and it's necessary to integrate these ideas into existing financial regulation or help regulation to adapt to these types of innovations in a way that will allow them to succeed and be sustainable.
Yeah. This is a random question about Ethereum, but I swear I see like some project comes up and one of the descriptions will say, oh, well, so-and-so was an Ethereum co-founder or something like that. I feel like there's dozens of these people. So do you have a good grasp of like who the heck was actually behind Ethereum? Was this truly dozens of people, or what was kind of the source of Ethereum's origination?
I don't want to say anything too controversial, but there's definitely a lot of people who say they were co-founders, but I mean, I can certainly remember the different stages at which different people got involved and then sort of being there for certain conversations. I think in 2014, my apartment in 15, maybe even in New York, was sort of a gathering place. I had a lot of extra rooms and let some of them stay there. And so got to really overhear a lot of interesting conversations and some of those meetings and developments. Yeah, and I probably, not everyone was a co-founder as in they were writing the code, but people had various different roles to play in terms of sort of spreading the gospel of Ethereum.
Yeah.
I actually sometimes think that maybe because I was so close, I'd obviously become involved and started spending a lot of time with these people because of the idea and it just seeming incredibly interesting. But I think I was still quite shocked when they were taken as seriously as they were, especially as quickly. But yeah, you did have quite a few smart people behind it who knew how to do that translation and to make it work. And of course, different people in different groups all have different motives as well. And there were, you know, a number of different people involved in that, but, yeah, a lot of brilliant minds, and it's actually worked. So that's obviously was something that was fascinating to watch, all those different dynamics and the fact that you can create a completely new global system. Yeah, I think I'm still kind of in awe of it.
Yeah. I mean,
I remember saying to one of the founders in 2015, like, I should write a book about this because this is just absolutely fascinating. And he's saying to me, like, no, no one would ever want to read that.
Would.
I'm sure there's plenty of books now. Yeah.
So, you know, I've gotten into all the DeFi side of things a lot over the past year. And to me, it seems like kind of the truest representation of what Ethereum can be, right? Because it's things that aren't that narrow scope of Bitcoin of like make a payment from, you know, one person to the other. And there's all this stuff that can happen between, you know, how lending works, or basically taking anything from the traditional financial services industry and trying to figure out how can we put this on a distributed network. Is what we're seeing with DeFi or like any of these newer projects like lending and borrowing and even trading on chain and some of this stuff, is that within the realm of what you thought would have been possible back then? Or has the discussion about like what Ethereum could be used for really evolved as, you know, people played with it and discovered for themselves how it could be used?
I think that was always part of the thinking. I just think that earlier on, like the narrative really changed overall in terms of like what people were able to conceptualize and what projects really catch on. And sometimes those things are actually quite difficult to predict in terms of what's going to resonate with people. I also don't think that Bitcoin in itself is limited. I think it's just a different type of system that has its own very strong use cases and its own sort of benefits. And it's quite, it's not really a comparable there. And I don't know if really the end point that we've reached or where we are now is where everything was meant to go and that these were simply steps along the way. I think that it's a much broader ecosystem than that. Mm-hmm. And that I don't think that we should really narrow the scope of our thinking there. But if we look back to 2015 and 16, and I think also this is sort of, there's two things that are working in parallel. There's the financial services industry and sort of society that's going on its own trajectory of shifts in terms of how people operate and what their understanding is of those industries and the possibilities behind them. And then there's the technology behind these systems like Bitcoin and Ethereum and blockchain technologies overall, and what is possible to build through those systems. I think that, you know, the experimentation continues to evolve, and we'll continue to see it shift until there's things that resonate with different communities. For example, right now, like these trading NFTs are resonating with some people. Maybe that is something that has longevity. Maybe it isn't. Maybe it transforms. I think also the same thing was with the ICOs in 2017. You saw a lot of people that were building applications, and the thinking there was that you would have a different token for every type of application, and that people would want sort of micropayments for different things, and that you would have a new version of Twitter or a new Facebook or a new messenger service that's built on top of this, and maybe that's what's interesting. But a lot of those projects seem to have shifted out. I think the financial services and the DeFi one, I think those are use cases that are more deeply embedded into the actual workings of the technology itself, because it is sort of a payments and a money system that it originates from. So those resonate now. And because it's early, there's gains to be made. So sometimes it's difficult to see what's the real attraction, whether it's people that are just wanting to make some earnings that they can, or whether it's really about an overall transformation of a space for other reasons. It can get blurry when there's money involved.
Yeah, and the protocol itself is wide open. So what people choose to do with it, or how they choose to, you know, take advantage of what's possible, is really up to them. And then what catches on. So it's not like Vitalik approves every dApp, you know, or anything like that. So it's, that's what fascinates me with Ethereum, is because of just how broad it is, because you're opening up this programmatic layer that anyone can do stuff with. Anybody can deploy a smart contract and go for it.
Yeah, it's a platform for real-time innovation, and it seems like it's a time where these technologies are finally beginning to gain acceptance, and And I think there's certainly room for that going forward. And it's extremely interesting. And there's clearly a need for it with the current financial system being what it is, and the possibility of creating financial system that is more open, that is more transparent, that is more inclusive. I think that's an extremely compelling concept.
So let's dig in a little bit more on how your career shifted over time, because it sounds like you went from what I'll call legacy to crypto native, like when you're with your job, I guess, with an exchange when you first got to London, back to legacy, and now back to crypto native. What's how does the perception of crypto change depending on your audience, like in the workplace? Like when you were first involved, you were in legacy systems, right? And starting to talk about crypto some, and then you went crypto native, and then back with HSBC, and then now you're crypto native again. How's that narrative shift, and like how have you seen that evolve over time?
Yeah, I think it's definitely been interesting. So I think there's certain groups of people who have always, within even the traditional systems, that have always been interested in technology and what role it can play, and conscious that it needs to play a greater role. But in terms of what that can be, I mean, I think we went from it being about mobile-centric, mobile money and sort of the payment space, and certainly a lot of the focus even in 2015 and 16 was around moving money and remittances and payments. In 2017, with the ICO boom, that actually made me, I think that was one of the reasons that I went back to the traditional financial services space. I think I just needed a bit of a break in a way. There was a lot of hype in the space. Blockchain was going to solve everything.
My industry on the blockchain, and here's my token, and here's my sale, and please give me $50 million.
Yeah, even with a lot of the work that we were doing through various platforms, looking at how it could potentially transform remittances, or looking at topics like financial inclusion and mobile money, and how do we get or potentially to use it for cash transfer programs for development finance or humanitarian aid. It just seemed quite a ways off. I was recruited by HSBC. I didn't expect to make that dramatic of a transition from digital assets, but
yeah.
Certainly there was a lot of interest in innovation overall in technology, in large financial institutions. I'd even, spoken at some other financial institutions on the topic before. And I think people were curious, but definitely more skeptical. Then I would say 2017, 2018, people were quite interested and wanted really to hear about blockchain technology and how that could be used. Again, it's sort of that similar parallel to wanting internet sites and saying, okay, yes, there is this technology that will create more efficiency, more connectivity, provide a sort of global layer.
Do you think there was a little bit of a paradigm shift there because of the 2017 bubble, that all of a sudden everybody knows what crypto is to some degree, and they're like, oh, maybe this is real and interesting and has staying power, versus, 2015? There was the 2013 bubble, but it was a lot smaller and more narrow. Do you think that there was a big shift in how crypto was discussed, especially corporately, between those two cycles?
Yeah, absolutely. There was just a lot more general awareness. Quite a few people had heard of Bitcoin. Maybe they took it more seriously in the more unexpected places, but you see Bitcoin ATMs, and that was sort of a fad for some time, or people who were sort of interested in it as a concept of, a side investment they could do. But I think also there was a lot of the narratives around this being used for illicit activities, or, you had a lot of hype in the media about sort of hackings and Bitcoin ransoms.
Oh, yeah. Gosh, I forgot about that.
And that was sort of that was really the main focus of the narrative. And it was really about thinking of it as an AML risk. If you were doing bank transfers from your bank, would your bank account get closed? Mm-hmm. A lot of the startups in the space really struggling to get sort of bank accounts and getting the rails that they need to start their own business. But we did also see some of the main exchanges really persevere and continue there. And you would have sort of more niche interest, say specific hedge funds who were interested in looking at that for their own strategies. But I think for the larger financial institutions, really regulatory clarity was going to play an important role there. But I think what was interesting was just how much we saw regulators really dive into the topic. And then in particular, I would say through 2018 and 19, the central banks, which aren't really the first people that come to mind when you think of innovators, but I think certainly they were aware of this being their potential territory and the possibilities that lie within. So you saw a lot of experimentation on that level as well.
When you went to HSBC, you were, I don't remember the exact title, but director of some sort of innovation, right? So I imagine a lot of that was regulatory, right? Like, whether working with regulators or working internally and saying, hey, this is where innovation is, and this is all the regulatory quagmire that we have because there's so many questions about stuff. Was that did you have a lot of relationships with regulators, and what was the conversation like there, whether it was HSBC or just in other realms, but kind of trying to bridge the financial innovation with, the conversations they were used to having around regulation?
Yeah, so working with the regulators was extremely important. In the UK, so based out of London in the UK, the FCA has a regulatory sandbox, which we actually, in my team, used twice to do fintech partnerships and to experiment with new business models. The focus of that was really around open banking and APIs and data sharing and data connectivity and the use of AI. So I think really our focus was on transforming our institution and banking and the capabilities overall. And that's sort of where the focus was at the time. You know, obviously there's interesting use cases of blockchain in areas such as trade finance. But yeah, I think for that role in particular, artificial intelligence was more the focus, and then mm-hmm. really just becoming moving to like API and cloud computing, and that's sort of where a lot of the discussions are, which I think is so. You know, I certainly missed very much the digital asset space, and stayed involved through my academic involvement, which is why working with Oxford University and the UCL for their Center for Blockchain Technology in parallel. And then I suppose just my friend group, and from having been sort of deep in the crypto world for a while. Yeah, I think, you know, I really wanted to come back for quite some time. It was about finding the right opportunity.
Yeah. So we'll spend our last bit talking about teaching some and Valour. Before we do, you said remittances, and I would never have thought about it, but it makes me think of Ripple and how much that narrative took off. And honestly, I don't know a ton of the history. Ripple never hit my brain waves until it was, 15 cents or something. But people don't realize how much Ripple grew in terms of at least acceptance or market cap or hype or something from when it originated to even getting to that, like 15, 20, 25 cents. Like, did it blow your mind how freaking massive Ripple got, and how people like these Ripple XRP community people, XRP army people, like how much they just latched on to that narrative? Was it just shocking to you, or did it make sense? What was your take on that?
It's quite the phenomenon.
Yeah, we can leave it there if you want, but it blows my mind, and I imagine because you kind of bridged the crypto versus banking ecosystem. Yeah, it makes me think.
But I've never had any interaction with Ripple.
Yeah, it just blows my mind how big it actually got. I can talk crap about Ripple. You don't have to, but it's stunning to me that it became as big as it became, considering the space it's in, and like, I don't know, it's mind blowing.
There's a lot of projects too, where you know it's really interesting. it's all been quite interesting, and sometimes hard to predict, and you don't necessarily know what forces are behind various projects. I think for me, that just comes back to a lot of the appeal of Bitcoin and projects that are truly decentralized, or especially, I mean, having an anonymous founder, I think that adds a sort of beauty to it.
Yeah, and it was purely the community and the adopters of Bitcoin that hyped it or promoted it, or it's not like this partnership train or a fundraise or roadshow and all this stuff. And it's much more organic in the way that Bitcoin is promoted over time. So we can leave that there. Just made me think of it when you talked about remittances a little bit. So let's get into where you are now. One, you mentioned you're teaching about crypto and blockchain at Oxford. So why don't we start there? And then you're the CEO of Valour, and I want you to tell us a little bit about what Valour does as well. But let's start with Oxford. What are you teaching? You've been doing this for a few years now, right?
Yeah, so I am an associate fellow. So that's an honorary title, and I do some teaching hours every year. Typically, this is for the MBA students or the Executive MBA students. They have a fintech elective, and we do a lecture on cryptocurrency and blockchain technology for them. And I think that's really been interesting because I've been doing it now since, I think, 2016. So just looking at some of the slides where I have with the coin market cap screenshots from every year since then, and looking at what's changed and what's stayed the same, which is certainly Bitcoin at number one. And then I was also one of the head tutors on the executive education program, the Oxford Blockchain Strategy program. And so that is a 6-week executive education online program.
What's been the uptick for those courses? Have people been pretty excited to learn about it through the university system like that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a huge amount of interest from professionals who either want to even potentially create their own startup and go down the route, or simply looking for ideas of ways to use this new technology and to bring this technology or sort of innovation thinking overall into their own organizations. I think online learning is fantastic for that and has really opened up a lot of new opportunities for people to be able to be entrepreneurs and to really push forward their own careers with new ideas and by learning new topics. Probably because of what's happened over the last year and a half, people are a bit exhausted and wouldn't mind getting into the classrooms now.
Yeah.
But hopefully we'll be able to do that again soon.
Yeah. And then now you got lured back to the crypto landscape and you're at Valour now. What is Valour? What's like the primary products set that y'all are putting out there?
Yeah. So Valour is an issuer of exchange traded products. So these are investment products that are listed on regulated stock exchanges and that investors, both retail and institutional investors, can buy through their bank or broker. And so they're traded on stock exchanges just like shares and stocks, and making them really efficient and easy to use and secure products, and allows individuals or institutions to gain exposure to a certain underlying, be that an asset, a single asset, or a basket of assets, or a fund. So as you would have seen in the news, I'm sure the first Bitcoin ETF was approved in Canada this week. Our products are ETNs, which are exchange-traded notes. So those are essentially tracker certificates, which track the price of a Bitcoin. Our first product is a Bitcoin-based product. It's called Bitcoin Zero because we're charging zero management fees, and that's listed on the Nordic Growth Market Stock Exchange in Sweden. And so it allows individuals through their brokerage, through their bank, to buy exposure to Bitcoin in either Swedish krona or euro denominated products that we offer.
And they're able to do that through a traditional securities exchange.
Yeah, the Nordic Growth Market, it's owned by Börse Stuttgart. It's a traditional exchange.
So you've got Bitcoin Zero, and then you also mentioned a basket of assets. Is that live yet?
Not yet. So we are working on that. We're working on our next products, which will be launched soon. So Bitcoin Zero, our first product, was launched early December on the Nordic Growth Market. We now have over 30 million assets under management, and coming shortly, we'll offer other single digital asset products as well as basket products, and look into other areas of innovation that we can allow investors to gain exposure to easily and securely. And it's really just about creating another option for investors in terms of how they want to be able to participate in these markets and gain exposures to new innovations. Just bearing in mind that not everybody maybe technically savvy enough or comfortable enough to purchase a digital asset directly, because of different rules that govern how they manage their money, they need to buy their investment products through an exchange, and then this just provides the opportunity for them to do that. And the idea for us is to really make sure that we make these as accessible to everyone to participate in this digital economy. And for me, that's sort of bridging these two worlds, the existing traditional finance world and the one that we see going forward. Obviously, we're strong believers in that, and that's where we see things will be going. But we are in this transition period, and I think it's important that everybody's allowed and able to participate in helping it grow and to gaining access to it, even if they may not sort of understand or be comfortable with other ways to do it at this point in time.
Yeah. So this always has fascinated me, because when I think of both individuals and corporations, it's okay to say, well, as long as this is my normal, not tax protected type of account, I can go sign up somewhere and buy Bitcoin through whatever exists in the space. But if I, one, have a tax protected account, I may only be able to buy securities, and if I'm in your jurisdiction, then I can, you know, go to my normal exchange, buy the ETN through, and have Bitcoin Zero as my access to that. The other, and this makes tons of sense to me, is if I'm a corporation and I want exposure, say, of my treasury to Bitcoin, you guys manage all of the underlying custody and all that. They just have to do what they already know how to do. Typically, is if they're exposing their treasury to other securities, they just are buying a security and off they go. They don't have to worry about how do I like maintain custody and have all these security practices within our corporation. Y'all make like products like yours make that significantly simpler, right?
Yeah, that's the idea.
Yeah. And is most of your uptake corporate so far, or do you also have a significant number of individuals that are taking part in it?
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of retail interest as well. Certainly, we're just a couple of months in. We haven't actually done any active marketing, but I think just because, especially with the interest overall that's happening, it was, of course, pretty good timing to be able to offer this type of product as we're seeing the increase in interest. One of our founder and directors, Johan Waterström, actually was one of the founders of XBT, which created the first product of this type, a Bitcoin tracker certificate in Sweden. And that was back in 2015. And so since we are also operating in Sweden, it's a market that I would say it's retail market is fairly advanced in terms of their understanding of this type of product. They've had one that's available for quite some time. And that was also one of the reasons for us to decide to go no management fees for this particular product, seeing it as something that's fairly commoditized at this point in time, and then be able to charge later for when we begin creating the more innovative and unique type of products.
Okay, so when you have no management fee, basically you're not relying on the revenue from Bitcoin Zero at all in terms of the growth of the company. You're planning on doing that through the different products that are more complicated to manage in the first place, right?
Yeah.
Not exactly. That there's no management requirement currently, like all that, the custody and the security and account management. Y'all have to pay for that. That requires your time and expertise. So you could charge for it, but from a competitive advantage standpoint, you want to be able to offer that as more of that commoditized product, and then offer more, whether it's diversified strategies, maybe with the basket or other types of stuff. That's where you feel like you could make additional money.
Exactly. And the focus right now is really on growth, and really accessibility for investors. And then we have, an aggressive growth plan for this year where we will have other products that then do bring a management fee.
Awesome. Well, I look forward to learning about those. Let's finish here. Is what do you want to leave us with? You've been in this space for a long time. You've seen cycles come and go. A lot of people that are listening, this happens every time there's the new bull market, like they get excited, they start listening to podcasts and stuff. So a lot of people that are listening today, they're going to be interested in the fact that you have been in for 8 years. What advice, not financial advice, but like maybe from a mindset perspective or whatever else, like what do you want to leave them with?
Yeah, I think I would want to say, obviously, it's really important to understand for yourself why you're interested in a certain thing. Different people will tell you could be promoting different tokens or different ideas. I think it's just really essential to do your own research and think about what really resonates with you on a fundamental level and where do you see the potential. And that's not necessarily always going to be where you have armies of people telling you to get into something. It might be in the areas where actually you really need to sort of stand your ground and think fundamentally about why does it matter to you, and kind of get used to having other people think you're crazy, but stick to your beliefs and understand why you have that view, and then try to stick with it through the ups and downs.
Hopefully
that will pay off.
And I can imagine too, like at least for you, Bitcoin's a big part of that. And every cycle people are like, no, this is going to destroy Bitcoin, or this is so much bigger and better than Bitcoin, or this has such a broader scope that's going to impact the world more than Bitcoin. And, you brought up the coin market cap screenshots. And I think one of the things of that, I think you can actually go back in history and look at those. If you look at the one from 2014 versus 2016, 2018, 2020, the stuff that's in, say, the top 15, top 20 coins, there's a lot of rotation. And it's probably a good idea to keep a lot of our exposure in the long term to the stuff that has had more staying power. That's kind of what I took from what you said there.
Yeah, but I think also there's a lot of new things that will come out that will be incredibly important, and you won't know, and people don't know at the beginning, just as we really didn't know at the beginning. I can remember so many people in sort of a New Year's 2014, saying you're crazy, and it's 1,000 now, but it will just crash, and
you
then
just need to sell it off
for forever. And, so you really. You really don't know, and you just got to stick to your beliefs and continue to explore and continue to learn and continue to be open to new possibilities as well, because things will ultimately change as well.
Awesome. Diana, I appreciate you sharing your knowledge with us today. Y'all can go and follow Diana, Diana C. Biggs on Twitter. Also, check out Valour, VALOUR.com, and see if it's a product that you have access to, or if nothing else, just see the way that they're pitching the addressable audience for bringing access to Bitcoin to traditional markets, which is an important thing to do. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to Set Protocol for being our partner. Go to ledgerstatus.com/sets to check that out. Diana, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
All right. Y'all have a good one.
Monuments crumble.